Welcome to this month's special guest interview.
This month, I'm very pleased to have Dr. Michael Colgan as my special expert guest. Dr. Michael Colgan is the founder and chairman of the Colgan Institute and an inspiration to millions of athletes and health enthusiasts worldwide. He is one of the world's most popular scientific experts in nutrition and a best-selling author. His latest publications include Nutrition for Champions, The Perimenopause Solution, and Strong Bones. Dr. Colgan and the Colgan Institute are known internationally for their research in sports nutrition. They have published numerous professional papers, 2 university texts, many books, and hundreds of articles for many sports magazines worldwide. Always on the cutting edge of scientific progress, Dr. Colgan is invited to lecture worldwide at universities, sport clinics, medical symposiums, trade shows, and corporate organizations. Dr. Colgan is also well-connected to CHI as our advisor and a consultant. Of course, the CSNA education program is a co-requisite for completing Michael's popular Colgan Power Program Trainer Certification course, and CHI promotes all of his books and courses. Good morning, Michael, and welcome to this month's edition of Sports Nutrition Update.
Good morning, Corey. Glad to be in touch again. You just caught us. We're just off to Europe. So, lucky.
Wonderful. Perfect timing. They say that timing is everything. Would you agree?
Yes, I think so.
So, just looking at your latest newsletter, and it's always so rich and full, and we're going to talk about some of the topics that I groomed the newsletter from. But, Michael, what's going on? What's in your mind this morning? What are some of the neat projects that you're working on right now?
Oh, I'm working on a paper I'm giving at the World Anti-Aging Congress in June, and pretty interesting stuff. I've been asked, from the stuff I presented last year, I've been asked to do a paper aging now to 2020. So that's really what is happening in the field and what we can do to essentially maintain our candidacy for the therapies that are going to be available in 2020.
And what are some of those therapies, Michael, that you see coming?
Well, the new sciences are, of course, the first is nutrigenomics, that is nutrition that is designed for the human genome. And we couldn't even start to do that until after 2003 when the human genome was characterized. So it's a fairly new science, but it's developing so rapidly, there's probably a new paper on it coming out every 5 minutes. There are probably 100 new journals worldwide, and it will revolutionize nutrition.
What do you think of the pharmaceutical interest in the human genome, wanting to identify the risk of disease, then designing drugs attached to that model, and then getting people even from birth or maybe even before?
Yeah.
What do you think of that approach?
I'm going to talk about some of those in my paper. That is the single nucleotide polymorphisms that signal future disease. And there's one that's just been identified, the P21 gene, that is a very good signal of a future heart attack, a myocardial infarction. And obviously there are a lot of cardiologists that are interested in identifying people with this gene, which they could therefore start to treat early. And of course there's vast amounts of money in it.
So would you agree, though, that how we bathe those genes over the course of our life is still maybe more important than the predisposition to the disease?
Much more important, yes. That's exactly it. And some of the stuff that I'm presenting in this paper is concerns the Pima Indians. The Pima in Arizona have an 80% obesity, 60% metabolic syndrome, 60% diabetes, and live a fairly short time simply because of their diet and their exercise. They eat the worst of the American diet, and they do, on average, less than 2 hours physical work per week. Now, they are genetically identical to the Pima Indians of the Sierra Madre, who have virtually zero metabolic syndrome, virtually zero diabetes, virtually zero obesity, work 22 hours a week on average, physical work, because they're farmers, and eat a simple diet of fruit and vegetables and tortillas. They're genetically identical. But the Pima of Arizona have the highest rate of diabetes in the world. So you see, there are many, many predispositions that need not be brought out in life, depending on the environment in which you place them.
We're still better off to understand both, I suppose.
Oh, of course, yes. There's a good reason for understanding it. When the P21 gene was identified, it was 2007. By 2008, a company had brought out a test for it, and they took it to the World Heart Organization conference, and they gave away the test. And more than 400 cardiologists went through the test to find out if they had the gene. So there's a great deal of interest, great deal of interest.
Now, the human genome, it was kind of unraveled, and the characteristics, as you mentioned, have been identified to some degree and with some emphasis on, you know, I guess a lot of different factors. But for those who are not familiar with what that means, what does that mean, Michael, a human genome?
Well, it's pretty simple. If you look at it, during evolution, various signals from the environment acted as primitive stimuli to primitive organisms to regulate their synthesis and storage. And then as more complex life evolved, these signals, which became known as nutrients, continued to be the major environmental signals that govern expression of genes. The DNA code was built from these signals. All of the proteins that our DNA code expresses are a result of its reaction to environmental signals. And right today, I mean, people like Stephen Clark of the University of Texas have shown quite clearly that signals from nutrient intake regulate the synthesis and the mix of the proteins and lipids that we're made up of. And they do so by influencing gene expression. So we are built from the environment that we came from. And that whole new science of nutrigenomics is designing the human diet to suit that system.
Wouldn't that be the great challenge today then for people that are into health and want to know exactly how much of what to take when it comes to, say, a proportion of fats, carbs, and proteins, or which vitamin and how much? Isn't that the challenge of knowing exactly like how much magnesium or selenium or potassium
yes,
I should take?
It definitely is, and the way that it's being found out, and it's pretty close to what, of course, we've come to by some other methods over the years. But essentially, there has been no genetic change in humans since before there was agriculture, because paleontologists will tell you about the what's called the 50,000-year genomic lag. That is, it takes 50,000 years of exposure to a new environment to make a very significant change in genes. And we haven't had that because we've only had agriculture for most of the world for only 9,000 years, one place in the world for 11,000 years. So there's been no change in our genes. So we actually have the genetic code that is suited to an environment before agriculture. And that's the environment that is being investigated right now as a basis for nutrigenomics.
On our tour last year, I met Dr. Lauren Cordain.
Yes, he's definitely a fan of this idea, and so am I.
Yeah, and so am I, no doubt. It just makes so much sense, especially mm-hmm. when, you know, he's got a lot of following, and so do you, and the more and more people that get away from the wheat and the dairy and the refined food and sort of head back in time and yet using a more sophisticated approach with the science that we now know. What a marvelous approach to extending our life and living well with less disease pathology.
It is. It's wonderful. And yet roughly 80% of the American population doesn't do it. They eat essentially artificial food and then they wonder why they are so unhealthy.
Man, I'll tell you, Michael, I have been in, I don't know how many, countless Walmarts and the various markets here, and watching what Americans put into their bodies.
Yes.
The carts are just full of taco chips, and they drink pop.
Yeah.
Like there's no tomorrow. You know, you read about it, but to actually see people that heavy, that obese, and they're building themselves out of this horrible quality food, you can really see where the ignorance and the lack of insight to want to learn has such an impact on a population of people.
Yes, I've heard this a number of times. That is, it's one reason why emerging populations, such as the large population that covers the area of Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Jordan, those emerging populations see that and use it as motivation to believe that they will overcome America.
Well, that's pretty amazing. So they're waiting for Rome to fall in on itself.
That's right. And they're not the only ones. The South Americans are exactly the same. Doesn't mean they'll come in with armies. It just means they wait for America to implode. And with more than 70% of the population now overweight to the point of illness, it's a very reasonable idea.
Yeah, it's amazing how there's an American flag posted in front of almost every home, especially that, and that Lone Star, actually they built it into the houses. You know, it's part of the frame of the houses in Texas.
Yes.
So this patriotism, and it's all about liberty and freedom, and yet these people have become enslaved to a diet that is controlled by corporations, and they're connected, as you well know, to the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry. It seems to be almost like a carefully manipulated plot that's based on generating revenue.
Manipulated, yes. It's manipulated for profit, and I think, you know, that people like Donald Trump would say, it's nothing personal, it's just business.
Yeah, no doubt, huh? But what you're teaching and promoting through your books and courses and the Colgan Institute provides a way out, and that's wonderful. So now let's get on to another topic. Let's talk about DHA and how important that is and why that has significant value in human nutrition.
Well, it's fairly simple. I presented some papers last year, not the only one. A lot of scientists have presented papers on the same thing, that one of the earliest DNA signaling systems was docosahexaenoic acid. It's been conserved across neural evolution from cephalopods, from the original ammonites, through fish, amphibians, mammals, primates, and man over the last 500 million years. It's a very old signal. And right now, the savanna theory of human evolution is being seriously questioned. And Michael Crawford's theory from London University, the of the coastal origin of Homo sapiens, is currently the best evidence we have. And we have from the places like the Classis Middens, the Pinnacle Point Caves, and 14 different caves, actually, in South Africa now, show that humans were using, that is, modern humans, Homo sapiens, were using seafood 120 to 160,000 years ago. And the earliest Homo sapiens now, of course, are the ones that Tim White found in 2003 at Herto in Ethiopia, the three skulls that have been dated definitively to 160,000 years. And then Curtis Marion from Arizona State showed that the Pinnacle Point midden and the tools that were found there are now dated to 164,000 years. Now, that's really important because before that, there wasn't enough time for the human brain to grow because the oldest humans were thought to be only 50,000 years old. But now we know they're at least 160,000 years old, and that gives the time necessary for the huge encephalization of the human cortex, which occurred in no other animal except marine mammals. And the only way it can occur, because its basic substrate is DHA, is by eating DHA. And DHA is that ancient signal that came through the brightest, you might say, of the sea creatures through mammals to man. But on the savanna, the primates did not live on the coast. The primates lived on the savanna, and they did not develop the cerebral cortex that we have got. The only animals that did develop a similar cerebral cortex are the marine mammals. And we think now that it's likely that humans developed bioencephalization of the human brain from eating seafood on the coast of southern Africa 160 to 200,000 years ago. Well, that's the key. We require that preformed DHA, which is only available in seafood, for brain evolution. That is the current theory of how humans developed.
What about a vegan? Now, would you use part of the argument against being a vegan?
Yes.
In relation to DHA, yes. Because you can't, DHA is not in plants, is it?
No, you get alpha-linolenic acid in things like flax and walnuts, etc. But unfortunately, we know from recent experiments that alpha-linolenic acid is insufficient for the maintenance of the human brain in the elderly, and it's insufficient for the growth, the normal growth of the human brain in infants. And we know why, because its conversion is very limited because of low levels of two rate-limiting enzymes, delta-5 and delta-40 saturase in humans. And those are the ones that convert part of alpha-linolenic acid. It also has delta-4 desaturase. It goes through three desaturations to convert it to docosahexaenoic acid. So we know that absorption of alpha-linolenic acid from plants, which did exist in the African plains, was insufficient for encephalization of the human brain during its 160 to 200,000 year evolution. That's it.
So I read that maybe the chimp didn't evolve into a human because of the lack of the
That's
DHA?
Right. Because the chimps lived on the savanna and there is no DHA there. Or very, very little. There is a little in the marrow bones of other animals, but not much. And there are other things, too. To encephalize the brain requires trace minerals, iodine and selenium, both of which are deficient in the savanna and are abundant in the coastal marine environment. And we know that dietary DHA is required for the normal development of the human brain and the retina in infants today.
So what is a practical way to get DHA then, Michael, for the person today living in, say, Toronto or Calgary or Vancouver? How do we get enough DHA?
Well, I like to get DHA by eating fish, wild fish. You don't get it very well from farmed fish because their lipids change because of the things that they're fed. But you get it from almost all seafood. And people think, of course, it's highest as it is in salmon and halibut and other cold water fish. But it also occurs to quite an extent in all shellfish, in shrimp, in lobster, in crab, in octopus. It's quite high in octopus. And, of course, herring and smelt and those fish. If you can't get it like that, then you have to take it in a pill. But it's never as good in a pill. Never.
And how many grams of DHA, if you were taking, say, a salmon oil or a mixed fish oil, number one, let's assume that it's not rancid and that it's reliable in terms of quality control. What would be a good dose?
Yes, well, I like to look at least 1,000 milligrams, between 1,000 and 2,000 milligrams per day for an adult.
Great. So, okay, so DHA, and then that kind of leads me, thinking about the brain, to melatonin. Is this something that you'd still recommend taking on a regular basis?
Well, if you look at it from the point of view that we've just been discussing, the most ancient signal of all is light. Light is the most ancient environmental signal that started the creation of life. And we know now that we've got an enormously complicated built-in system for receiving light and producing melatonin in the pineal gland. And we have a area of the hypothalamus called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the body's timing mechanism. And that times everything. Now, in the paper that I'm giving in June, I'm showing that the decline of melatonin levels over the lifespan, and the decline of melatonin was based on, of course, natural selection and reproduction, as are most of the things in our body. So around about age 45, it gets below the viable level. But prior to that, because of the destruction of the human system by the food that we eat, it now gets below that level at around about age 35. And so our recommendation is that everybody takes melatonin in pill form or by eating various things that have high melatonin levels from age 35 on.
Good stuff, good stuff. Michael, I want to talk about your two new books, Strong Bones and the Perimenopause Solution.
Right.
They look great always, and I'm sure that, you know, a lot of the drawings are your own inside, as you usually they are. But what is the maybe synopsis on each of the books, to stay maybe starting with Strong Bones?
Well, of course, the principle that we've all followed, you and I and many, many others for many years, the first thing is the principle of synergy. We got sort of a bit tired of people sending us all these emails about the different products of calcium and vitamin D, and some put other things in and some didn't, and they're all advertised on TV as if they're going to save your bones. So I wrote a basic book telling you essentially the bare bones. What is the content of your bone and what is essential for bone to grow? And there are a large number of things. It's calcium, phosphorus, potassium, magnesium, strontium, zinc, silica, boron, fluoride, vitamin D, vitamin K, all of those things, plus, of course, your hormone cascade, determine how your bones are going to continue to grow. And for many years now, we have been taking people who are what you call on the fracture line. That is, they've been told they have osteopenia or osteoporosis, and turning them back from that line. And we know it's successful because we've had some people now who we've kept off that fracture line for more than 20 years. And yet, still, the public goes on and on about these ridiculously deficient supplements. And, of course, the pharmaceutical companies, they don't want to sell the supplements at all. They want to sell drugs that will either influence the retention of the osteoclasts that take away bone or stimulate the osteoblasts that grow bone. Those are the most recent drugs, which are the best. But it has created such a false idea of osteoporosis in our society that it just made me want to write the bare bones about the truth of it all.
So when a middle-aged woman walks into a health food store and asks the clerk for something for her osteoporosis and he gives her or she gives her a calcium supplement, really, how much good is that product going to do?
No good whatsoever. No good whatsoever, because all of the things I just mentioned to you are essential in order to grow bone. I mean, if you have enough calcium but not enough magnesium, and you don't have any strontium, you don't have any zinc, you don't have any enough vitamin D, which is very common, you don't have vitamin K2, you're not going to grow bone. All you're going to do is to put extra calcium in and extra calcium out.
And, of course, resistance training.
Oh, well, in order to grow bone, you obviously have to have the pressure on the ends of the bones. You've got to have pressure on the ends of the bones for them to signal the creation of a new particle of bone. Without that signal, there is no creation of bone, no matter what you eat. And we found that out when the astronauts went into space. And they have never, this is interesting, they have never been able to cure some of those guys. When they came back, they lost so much bone They'd never been able to replace it. Now in space, they do resistance exercise of some magnitude, and they still come back with considerable bone loss.
Michael, I actually had the opportunity to go to the Houston Space Center, and I really enjoyed that.
Oh, yes.
Saw the rockets and went to the Johnson Space Center, and I've always been so fascinated with the search for what's out there, and I think that's similar to what you and I are doing here on the Earth. We're looking for the truth. We're searching for the answers to the questions that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they come back to things that we've followed for a long time, and that is the principles of synergy of your nutrition, that having intense levels of nutrients in the food that you eat, having no calorie-full foods that are nutritionless, and doing the right exercise. It hasn't changed. It's just the whole new science since the Genome Project is enabling us to refine it.
And the perimenopause solution. What is perimenopause? What does that word mean?
Oh, it means around the menopause. And the reason that I wrote it is because many women are told today they're in perimenopause. It was not recognized till 2003 as a condition. I wrote about it first in Hormonal Health in 1994. And it wasn't recognized by the American Medical Association as an actual clinical condition until 2003. But there are 11 hormones involved, not just estrogen. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because in Hormonal Health, I gave a prescription for maintaining your hormone cascade. And the reasons for doing that, simply to avoid heart disease, to avoid Alzheimer's, to avoid all sorts, to avoid osteoporosis, to avoid those diseases, it is essential to maintain some hormone cascade. Now, in males, it fails much slower, but still by age 65, males are in a similar sort of position. But with women, it starts around about age 35. And all of the symptoms that come with it are very disturbing, and they go and get treated for all sorts of things, which are, unfortunately, a symptom of the coming menopause. So I've detailed the 25 symptoms that are most common and how they occur and what hormones are involved and what hormones we can actually safely manipulate. And the one other reason I wrote the book is since 1994, the FDA and other health organizations have come round to the use of the new hormones, the new bioidentical hormones. And so I wanted to list those and describe them and how they differ from the hormones that were used last century, and how they're much safer, and what we should do when we are taking them. And I did it in 1994, but now the FDA has approved bioidentical estrogens and progesterone that they did not approve then.
So do you think that they're definitely safer?
Much safer.
And the way to go now?
Yes, but there are caveats, of course, about the use of all hormones. I mean, you've got a very powerful, growth-stimulating substance that you're putting into the body, and one of the most powerful ones we know is estrogen. And so you better be very careful with what you're doing with it. And as I describe in the book, some estrogens are sold in a tub like a cosmetic cream, and you put your finger in it and take a little dose and rub it on your arm. That is ridiculous for a medication that is biologically incredibly active. So I point out the only way to do it is to have it in a syringe or a measured dose release canister and not expose it to, of course, air or light or heat or the infections from your fingers, because it's not going to last. It's not going to remain viable. It's very biologically active. It will react to all those things. And yet it was served up as if it was a cosmetic.
You know, Michael, I met an old-timer here in Alabama, and he said that his mother taught him this simple rule. Life is 90% common sense and 10% book learning.
I guess.
So it's amazing. I mean, what you just said is so simple, but so profound. It's amazing how many people don't even think about what you just said.
We get them every week, women writing to us saying, my estrogen cream has gone yellow. Is it still safe to use? And we know exactly. They've bought one of the ones, and these are prescription medications that's in an open tub, an open jar, like a face cream. It's just ridiculous. I mean, face creams are generally inert, have generally no effect whatsoever on anything except to make the skin look a little greasier. And it doesn't matter what way you serve them up. But when you've got a very active transdermal medication, you have to serve it up precisely, and you have to protect it.
I wanted to bring some attention now to your website, Michael, because you have a really nice feature there, a presentation that is visual and an excellent education quality. But I'm just on the website now, and I can see that it's about circadian rhythms, and I've gone through this myself, but this is something that you are adding as a new feature that you charge for.
Oh, yes, they're getting changed. I don't do it myself, any of that, but the staff put some of my presentations on, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. And just to mention that you are having a power camp this year in August, and that Tracy and I will be joining you. We look forward to seeing you on Salt Spring and to sharing some good times and to drink some fine red wine.
Yes, well, I'm looking forward to it. We're going to try and make it a fairly sort of small and intimate camp, and hopefully we'll get out around the island and see some of the organic vegetables and organics that are available, and the salmon processing plant, and the fresh seafood, and maybe do a bit of kayaking and a lot of fun things.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Again, for everybody out there, it's ColganInstitute.com. So get to that site, and all of your books and your vitamin supplements, and we didn't even get a chance to talk about that too much, Michael, but you do have some new products out, and they're all listed there, aren't they?
Yes, they're all on the website. I'm pretty sure they are. Yes, we developed a new line from last May, and we're adding to it now, and it's growing quite well.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's fantastic. Well, Michael, I just want to wish you also a happy birthday. I know that's coming up in a few days.
Yes, that's right. We'll be off to London for that.
Well, listen, have a fantastic trip. I look forward to visiting with you and Leslie coming up soon. And maybe you can leave us with a profound word or an insight to life so that we can digest that for the rest of the day.
Yes, I think that the best we can do now in terms of inhibition of aging is to do the things that maintain our candidacy for the therapies that will be available by 2020. By then, we will be able to regrow from your own tissue almost any bit of you that gets damaged.
Dr. Michael Colgan is the founder and chairman of the Colgan Institute and an inspiration to millions, a good friend and a good ally and a very reliable man when it comes to the information that we need to move forward. Thank you so much, Michael, again.
It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure, Corey. Look forward to seeing you in August.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hope you've enjoyed the topics discussed and our special guest interview on this edition of Sports Nutrition Update. SNU is produced monthly and is distributed internationally by the Corey Hawley Institute. To learn how you can subscribe to this unique and motivational audio program, please visit CoreyHawley.com or call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 1-866-433-1595. That's 1-866-433-1595. This is Scott Barrett, wishing you the very best of health and fitness for life.
Representing lifestyle. New way of life. Listen. It's SNU, sing along, it's true. Yo, coming through straight, Malik with sports nutrition update. Prolong your life, live long, stay strong, for it won't be long till your time is gone. So I sing this song to pass on wisdom. Hit us up at CoreyHolly.com. Love your life, live right, things will be alright. Knowledge is key, just follow our lead. You'll see a change in heart and health, which leads to wealth and higher self-esteem. Follow your dreams and see. Follow your dreams and see.